Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every day in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my quick guess. My guest today is Robbie Cook, who is a chef at the Koro. Koro opened in October 2023 and is located next to the Grand Central Station in Manhattan. And Robbie's path to becoming a successful sushi chef is unique and impressive. He joined us on episode 37 in 2016 when he was the executive chef at the Morimoto and talked about his intriguing journey to become a successful sushi chef. As a brief summary of episode 37, inspired by the world of sushi and its tradition, Robbie studied at the California Sushi Academy, and after graduation, he proved his talent at notable restaurants in New York, including Bond Street and the Morimoto. There used to be a belief that great sushi could be made only by Japanese chefs trained in Japan, but now we see so many cases to disprove the idea, and Robbie is a perfect example. He not only understands the tradition and traditional value of sushi, and also communicates it effectively to the global audience with his own sushi-making philosophy. So today we'll discuss how a young American decided to become a sushi chef, how he managed to hone his skills to become one of the top talents in the U.S., his sushi-making philosophy behind his omakase menu at Koro, Robbie's advice for future sushi chefs, and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We truly appreciate your feedback. Now let's start a conversation with Robbie Cook. Hello, Robbie. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Akiko. Thank you for having me back on.
So this is exciting. In the matter of, I would say, 8 years, your career really furthered even more successfully. So congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, it's a new venture, and glad to get it started finally, and excited to see where it goes.
Right. And you really experienced, went through surviving the COVID as well. So it's been very impressive what you've done so far.
Thank you. Thank you.
Right. So for listeners who have not listened to episode 37, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
I am from Emmitsburg, Iowa. It's a small town, northwest Iowa. Definitely didn't grow up eating Japanese food, I'll tell you that. We were more like meat and potatoes, you know, macaroni and cheese, pasta, spaghetti, you know, things like that.
But how did you get into sushi, and where did you study sushi?
I got into sushi when I was going to college at University of Iowa in Iowa City. A little more diverse, like, culture, and you know, Iron Chef was getting popular. One of my friends was Korean, kind of taught me how to make kimbap, and I kind of just took from there. You know, had access to more Asian ingredients, and just started making sushi on my own, and kind of fell in love with it. You know, especially like working around food in like the produce department at like an organic grocery store. So then I found out about this sushi school in California, California Sushi Academy. And I went there in 2003 for about 5-6 months and then moved to New York right after that to go to the Institute of Culinary Education, kind of to round out my training. But I ended up getting a sushi job right away when I moved to the city.
Right. And I hear in Japanese people say they are very impressed with the level of sushi restaurants in New York these days. And before you became the sushi chef at Koro, you worked at well-recognized sushi restaurants in New York, including Bond Street and Morimoto, by, of course, the Iron Chef Masaharu Morimoto. So,
yeah, yeah.
Right? So that's really like the, you know, pedigree is proven. But what lessons did you learn from all those excellent experiences at top restaurants in New York and, you know, overall everything from techniques to your mindset?
Yeah, I mean, I was very fortunate at the sushi school. You know, Toshi, the owner, had three restaurants, but the school was very informative. Like, they taught us, you know, everything about sushi and kind of, you know, a little bit like Japanese culture and kitchen. So when I got here, I had like an understanding. Obviously, I started studying more on my own about sushi and Japanese culture. But yeah, I was fairly young, you know, at Bond Street. So I just kind of absorbed everything and learning, you know, that was more, I wouldn't say, you know, they're using like different ingredients, not straightforward Japanese. So I was able to learn so much so quickly, which was very great. Plus, we were super busy at that time. I'm sure they still are busy, but able to get my hands on a lot of fish and make a lot of sushi and just kind of learn so much. And Morimoto, you know, that was just a crazy experience, you know, growing up, or once I got into sushi, you know, Iron Chef popular once again, and then being able to work with him, that was pretty amazing. And, you know, Makoto was there and Omai-san, you know, the knowledge and the product we had, it was super amazing.
Right, so Makoto and all those Omai-san, they are graduate of Morimoto, kind of school of Morimoto.
Sure, sure.
Right. But you know, back then Morimoto opened in New York in 2006. So back then, I think you were almost the first generation of non-Japanese sushi chefs who started to show talent. So how was the experience? Like, you know, he's a white guy making sushi.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's tough at first, you know, just kind of keep my head down and work as hard as possible. I actually wasn't like, when they hired me, I didn't get onto the sushi bar like right away. So I had to do like apps and stuff, but Makoto would let me cut fish, you know, because I had the skills already to do it. So, you know, I was prepping and coming in early and staying late, prepping fish, and then finally, you know, after 6 months or so, then started getting into the sushi bar more and more, which was great.
Right. So Makoto is Makoto Okua. He who has a little empire, I think, in around Florida, I guess. So
he just opened DC and Vail too this winter.
Right. He's such a good human being as well. So no wonder he's thriving. So, all right, so we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll dive into Harobi's new restaurant, Koro, and his sushi making philosophy behind it now. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats on HRN, Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Robbie Cook, who is a chef at Coral, which opened in Manhattan in October 2023. So, let's talk about your new place, Coral. So, Coral, or Coral at the Point 7, is an only 10-seat secret space hidden behind energetic seafood restaurant, Point 7, near the Grand Central Station in Manhattan. So, what is the concept of Coral?
Yeah, so Coral, kind of like a hidden little gem, you know, 10 seats only, very nice, comfortable, modern space, not necessarily Japanese looking. Concept, you know, we are doing omakase, but I'm more, you know, since I went to culinary school too, I kind of focus on my otsumami, like the small pre-sushi dishes. So different sauces and garnishes and different cooking techniques, I would say. And then I guess, you know, sourcing from Japan as well, you know, buyers in Toyosu and just using extremely nice products. Yeah.
Can you explain for the listeners who are not familiar with like a sort of sushi course menu? Because we think of sushi at the sushi restaurant, but there are several dishes normally that showcases the season and chef's kind of philosophy. So what are the existence? What's the meaning of those pre-sushi dishes?
Yeah, now there's so many omakase restaurants, so each chef has their style. You know, some could be like light sashimi dishes, some little bit cooked miso soup into the sushi. But the small dishes are kind of to get you warmed up for the sushi, small bites that are instead of like just straight sashimi with wasabi and soy, I do a little more like flavorful sauces that really pair well with the fish, I guess.
Right. So people call it the sushi kaiseki or some kind of more than just ready-to-eat sushi.
Similar to kaiseki, you know, a little bit. But I do not so many cooked dishes, but I do a couple cooked dishes just to break up the raw fish all the time, which is good. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I think now that there's so many sushi bars that serve omakase menu, I think people, I really want a lot of diners to pay attention to what, how much energy the sushi chefs put into the first several courses before sushi, because it's so beautiful. And sushi, of course, like other Japanese dishes, it really shows the seasonality. So yeah, I think it's
definitely wake up the palate, you know, and try to get the fish to really pop. And yeah.
Right, and then Japanese people like the with the sake and just like a good beginning.
Of course. Right? Yeah. Right.
So how did you become the chef at Coral?
I have known Franklin Becker he's the chef owner, Point 7. So I know just through like, you know, food events, food and wine and events over the year, we've known each other. And he just kind of reached out to me with this new project, and he wanted to do like some sushi focused as well.
Yeah, right. That's interesting. The Point 7 is such an energetic place. I mean, after work and near Grand Central Station, like office people, and like so hustle bustle, beautiful, energetic place. But then Coral is back behind it, and you open a sliding door. You don't even expect there's a room in there, and that's your stage.
Yeah, you know, Franklin, they had an idea of what this could be, and then I wanted something smaller, you know, like being at Morimoto, we were doing so much volume, and that's not something I wanted to keep doing anymore. So 10 seats, I really wanted to focus on me, like my taste and my sushi and just a more like kind of like close experience with the guests, I guess.
Right, so that brings me to next question. So you offer only the omakase menu, hatkoro, which means leave it to the chef. So you decide what to offer to guests yeah. every day. So you have made sushi for the last almost 20 years or so. So
sure.
What's your sushi making philosophy at this point?
Yeah, maybe we'll open lunch later, you know, and in the future, do more a la carte. But yeah, right now, omakase only. It's about like 15 to 17 courses. Mainly everything's sourced from Japan. I have buyer in Toyosu, but maybe a couple local things. But I like to, you know, let the fish speak for itself, not overcrowd it with too much like sauce and flavor. But I also like to use like keep things in season and just super fresh.
Right. So out of your 15 to 17 courses, do you have any specific theme? Like you want to incorporate more creativity or more traditional?
Mine's definitely more creative. You know, stick with one fish and then like two or three other ingredients, just so you can really taste the fish and maybe the sauce really brings out more flavor of the fish. But yeah, my small dishes, I like to be more creative. Sushi is fairly straightforward, maybe a couple little garnishes. You know, obviously caviar and truffle everybody's using now. So I do use that a little bit as well.
Right. So that reflects your concept of sushi, right? So, you know, you grew up in America and you know the palate of American diners, but you do know I remember the Morimoto, Chef Morimoto, really endorsed your skills and sense of making traditional sushi, and you can make sushi in Ginza, which is the ultimate stage for sushi chefs. So
yeah, I definitely pride myself on sushi skills as well. Really study hard and, you know, just, yeah, 20 years now I've been doing it. So being able to read the guests and, you know, read the fish too, you know, make sure the fish is top quality in season. Yeah.
So what's the borderline that you cannot cross as being traditional?
I mean, now you can pretty much do anything, you know? So right. At this point in the career, I can kind of do what I like, but I like the sushi a little more traditional side. Obviously, like I said, maybe different garnishes, toppings, different soy sauces. I make, you know, all my sauces here. So try to keep it more flavorful, not just only soy and wasabi all the time.
So that's interesting because I know that there are so many creative sushi bars, but also more Japanese traditional sushi chefs come here, open restaurants in New York. So, for example, what kind of soy sauce do you think is traditional versus what's creative? Maybe you can have some examples, right?
Yeah, I mean, soy can just be straight soy, but a lot of chefs have their own, like, nigiri sauce. It could be, like, sake, mirin, tamari, some add bonito, maybe kombu. But that's all like kind of your preference. So you know, as we develop the flavor profile, you can change, lighten it, make it more heavy. You know, with like a zuke type, maybe I do mine with like chilies and garlic. So it's a little more on the heavier side. But you have to play with the fish, you know, if it's more flavorful or you want to bring out the subtleties of the fish as well.
Interesting. So the addition or increased portion of kombu or other Japanese traditional ingredients, that's one thing. I think it's still staying within a very strictly traditional realm. But you add garlic or chili, that's like very American, refreshing creativity.
Yeah. Yeah, it could be different ponzus as well, like using different citruses. We have a very nice citrus purveyor that's local and he's amazing. Different yuzu, like different kumquats. So I can make like different flavorful ponzus or like an amazu type sauce as well.
Right. So you mentioned that you get your seafood from Toyosu Market, which is originally from the Tsukiji Market, but the world's oldest and biggest fish market moved to the nearby and for to better facilities because it's right. So old, right? So, but your connection or connections with all those fish purveyors in the Toyota market must be very difficult to establish. So how hard is it? And how did you create your connections in the Toyota market?
Well, yeah, once again, very fortunate to be working with Morimoto. Now, you know, more omakase bars, they have different buyers, which is great. But like, you know, Chef Morimoto, we kind of set up the direct buying like way back 2006. And I was fortunate, you know, to be able to travel to Japan almost every year. So they would like pick me up at the market and show me around. And then like after COVID, you know, I kind of lost touch with everybody. But I linked up with one of our original buyers. He's working for a newer company now, Akira-san. So now I'm using him again and he kind of knows what I like, you know, the sizing, the quality, how to prep the fish, which is great.
Mm.
Yes.
Right. So this sounds like this is a strong network that's been existing before and after the move of the market. And also, despite the COVID, they maintain strong as a foundation of
yeah.
the tourism market.
We're always kind of checking up, you know, people we send messages, you know, Instagram is easy now. You can send message and people are doing line. So they send pictures back and forth. I can pick fish. I can pick uni. Yeah, it's great.
Mm, right. And I mean, the distribution of seafood in the U.S. has much improved in the last decades or so, thanks to, I think, partly the popularity of sushi and even the French restaurants or American restaurants use that distribution. Right. So, but also at the same time, I hear that more interesting local seafood has become available. So do you find interesting local seafood as well, in addition to the Toyosu's best seafood?
Yeah, I think, well, obviously, you know, Japan has the best fish. That's it's hands down, you know, Japanese fishermen, they know how to take care of the fish. The purveyors at Toyosu, you know, how to package and ship, which is just like second to none. But yeah, like recently, obviously, like clams, we really can't get. So I like, you know, gooey duck and local clam. But for 0.7, we're using a newer company. I don't know if it's newer. It's new to us. What we just started using. It's called Dock to Dish from Montauk. So they catch like whatever's fresh for the week and like, which I've been using a little bit. So we use some tilefish, like golden tilefish last week was super nice. We're getting local flukes, which are really nice. And a product that I haven't seen before, which is great. They're called Royal Red Shrimp. Kind of deep water. Not like, it's almost got a kind of like lobstery taste, but still very soft, like kind of like Botan Ebi-ish, which is really great. So I put that in my miso soup. I'm going to do nigiri tomorrow night with those. Should be, yeah, super tasty.
Interesting. Yeah. So like you mentioned earlier, I think fish itself is fish, but you can't change that quality very easily by packaging, even slaughtering to packaging. And I heard Japanese sushi chefs are surprised that all the fish ordered carefully come in a big box and the bottom one is smashed versus Japanese shipping. One fish comes in one box and nothing's smashed.
That's right. What it's all about. Yeah, even Dr. Dish, I told them, you know, hey, you know, how to ice the fish a little bit and just kind of, you know, be a little more careful. And but it's great quality stuff already.
Yeah, I heard that the fishermen and the distributors started to learn the Japanese techniques to process fish more carefully so that it can really sell at a much higher price as well.
Yeah, definitely. You know, you should clean out the guts right away and the gills. It really helps preserve the fish, you know, keep the quality much fresher and longer too.
So it's a win-win, right? It's good for the fishermen for a higher price.
Totally,
for you,
totally.
Right?
Yeah.
For you and also diners, of course. If it's locally well prepared and available, the price should be cheaper than all everything from the, you know, ship from Tsushima.
Japan is pricey these days, man. Super pricey, but that's sushi, I guess.
Right. Okay, so based on those really well-selected seafood, could you give us some examples of your offerings at Coral?
Yeah, let's see. So like otsumami is just kind of like the small dishes to get started. I'm using tuna from like Oma, Aomori, kind of like small sashimi, onion, soy, miyoga, shiso. We'll see last week. Oh, we use a Nantucket Bay scallop too, which is super nice. Season's almost over, which is great. Kind of sub it that in and out with like tairagai, which is the pencho clam. That could have like a kizami, wasabi ponzu, fresh wakame and kombu pickles, maybe some kinome with sancho pepper leaf. In season right now, I started using the sakura masu, which is the cherry blossom salmon, which is one of my favorite kind of wild salmon for the cherry blossom season. And then I cold smoked that with cherry blossom wood, a little plum and ginger, like dashi soy gelée or bonito soy. Yeah. Some truffle.
I really remember I was lucky to go to your place before the season changed, before the cherry season. And you smoked the fish with apple tree because it's reflective of the season. And now it's definitely a cherry tree. Yep. That's very cool.
Yeah, switch that out. Yeah, wild yellowtails on the menu too. See, that season's pretty much done soon. And then, yeah.
The other thing, I was impressed at when I dined there, you used, you know, for kimedai, this is the best. You used the salt from Sado Island and you added lime, which people don't you think of in Japan. So that's a really bright acidity, but not too much. So effective to elevate the flavor of the fish. So I think that's your creativity that you mean. I think it's subtle, very delicate, but it's very distinctive from a highly traditional style of Japanese sushi.
Yeah, you know, would love to if we could get sudachi all the time. I love sudachi with, you know, kimedai, a little bit the sea salt from Japan Sea. But I'm using the key lime from, it's called Bumi Growers, Yuzu Lemons. So he grows like these really nice key lime, not like over acidic, you know, which are really, really nice. Mm-hmm. And it kind of pairs well with the fatty kinme. And then it's kind of a refreshing start for sushi instead of straight soy sauce.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, again, but sushi is local, that was born locally in regional places in Japan. So what's available was used for sushi. So using lime instead of sudachi is a very natural development of American sushi in a way. So that's very traditional. Yeah, it's just very true to the authenticity of sushi. So who comes to Coral?
Who comes to Coral? Well, I have like regulars from all the Morimoto days, you know, old friends, and yeah, plus we're developing new clientele, some of the businesses around here and, you know, friends of Franklin and those guys. So, but yeah, a lot of my older clientele and gradually getting a new customer base as well, which is nice. Yeah.
Right, because the location, Morimoto was in Chelsea, and Grand Central is completely different, midtown.
Totally different.
Right. So, do you see different demographics?
Yeah, a little bit. Definitely. Downtown scene is a little more casual. Plus, it's kind of like a different dining environment. Morimoto is like a bigger restaurant. You could do omakase, you could order a steak. Here, you know, we're doing straight omakase for now. People still are, you know, working from home. So Monday and Friday tends to be on the slower side, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, right. After COVID, I think Thursday is the last pre-COVID Fridays. And Monday, Fridays are a very quiet time, I heard.
Yeah, it's so different. It's different scene, so.
Right. So, well, have you seen any changes in your guest palette since you started making sushi in New York in the early 2000s? It's a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. The people are way more refined now. Their tastes have definitely developed, especially if they're real, like, sushi people. You know, they can tell the difference between, you know, Bafun uni or Murasaki uni, or they recognize uni by brand names now. So definitely more sophisticated. You know, back then we used sushi bar, you could just order, you know, piece by piece and a little more casual. But now, yeah, so many omakase places, plus the super high-end omakase. People's tastes are definitely more refined.
Mm. Right. One thing about omakase is that it's almost like it's a designing of the flow of your palate experience, right? So it's not just randomly serving different dishes. So
sure, that, sure.
Right. What's your kind of rules to design your courses? Do you have any ideas of specific ideas?
Usually, you know, we kind of go light to heavy and then kind of back to light and heavy again. But nowadays you can kind of switch and play. It's not so, I mean, you know, I'm not Japanese and doesn't have to be fully traditional. So I kind of just switch and kind of play around. And especially if guests come back again, get repeat guests, then I'll just kind of switch and move things around. Could be start with something a little more punchy and heavy, and yeah, mix and play around. It's nice.
Mm. You serve the miso soup somewhere in the middle, right?
Yeah, it's nice to kind of break it up instead of, like, usually miso soup's like at the very, very end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really appreciated that because I think my body really needed kind of healing moment. And it's really nice, you know, it's a nice intermission. And I thought it was genius to do that without getting
stuck. Doing like a seared fish dish too, and then a mixed rice dish, which is nice breakup from the raw fish. And then the miso soup was good. I've been playing around with, you know, bay scallops, norisori, baby eel, tile fish. I put the shrimps in there too, so it's kind of fun. And then I'm also doing like a fried fish dish at the kind of towards the end to break up sushi one more time.
Mm. Right. Yeah, there's a kind of like a nice accentuated rhythm, which I really thought was good and a very satisfying experience. Maybe it could be the same. Yeah, 15 courses could be boring, but, you know, depending on how you design it, it's almost like a theater mindset.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I like to switch things up, not just straight flow all the time and mix and play with dishes, especially, like I said, if guests come back, then, you know, change plateware, change the design of the menu a little bit, switch some fish in and out. Yep.
But the way you do is in the fried food in between is not kind of like dramatic way, very subtle. The delicate adjustment, I think the U.S. style of, I would say, modification. I don't know if it's the right word, but the way you express fried food is also very Japanese too. So I thought that's your style of creativity, and I thought it was very successful.
Kind of like a katsu style. It's tasty. Tasty nice. Fish.
Yeah, but it's in the flow of sushi.
Definitely.
Menu, right?
Definitely.
So, well, what is the most exciting thing about making sushi in New York if you compare this hypothetical situation that you were a sushi chef in Japan? Just imagine.
I think maybe less restrictions here. You know, you can really, like I said, I can play around and do things a little more fun, I guess. Not so rigid as maybe it might be at a sushi bar in Japan.
Mm. Right. Well, you have less convenient access to the Toyota market, but well, maybe if you were in Japan, you could be, you don't have to compete shoulder to shoulder to other traditionally trained chef, right? I mean, if you think of opening your own place in Tokyo, you could have been a big hit also.
So. Sure. Yeah, that would be fun. That would be fun.
Yeah, but I think Japanese chefs are more becoming more creative in Japan as well, right?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, you can definitely see the change happening, and especially like the Otsumami courses and things like that.
Right. So perhaps this globalization of sushi is inspiring Japanese tradition, which is, I think, is very healthy.
So yeah, sushi is just everywhere, you know, especially with like Instagram, and people can see like what everybody's doing and kind of play off of it and do your own spin. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah, and especially someone who grew up eating sushi, I think it's going to be interesting how sushi is going to develop in this country. It's
of course, only. Yeah.
Yeah. So I heard that in the 1950s and well, 60s even, people loathed the idea of eating raw fish. But why do you think sushi has become so popular in the U.S., like we talked about? So in other words, what is the universal appeal of sushi?
I think, you know, just the freshness of it and how you feel after sushi. It's not like eating a cheeseburger or a pizza or like a heavy... Or like a heavy French meal, you know, like butter and butter and cream. It's just something more, probably comes off more healthy, and, you know, fish is just more refreshing, I guess.
Right. And also people lost the bias about eating uncooked fish.
Oh, totally. Yeah, totally. Now it's just so common. It's everywhere. And plus, you know, from low end to high end, you can get many different experiences, and people just love sushi now.
Right. And even, I don't know how many times you wash your hands as you cook, make sushi, and it's raw, but it's like extremely clean food, even more compared to cooked dishes. So.
Yeah, exactly. That's another thing, you know, just healthy, clean. You're not feeling too heavy after. So, right. Yeah. Definitely, I wash my hands like a million times a day. So,
right,
little dry in the winter.
Right. Oh, but you know,
the fish oils help.
Right. Definitely. Yeah. Omega-3. Okay. So, some of our listeners may be interested in pursuing a career as a sushi chef. So, do you have any advice for them?
Yeah, just, you know, study up before, you know, read like Japanese cookbooks, read your fish book, have like, you know, have basic knowledge of all the fish, like sushi items, and, you know, practice on knife skills and cleanliness, right?
Of course. Well, I heard that the cleaning, it's not a joke, before you touch rice and the fish, you have to know how to clean, because that's the foundation, and also respect to fish
itself. Definitely, yeah. Clean cutting boards, clean everything. Then start working with fish and just have a general knowledge of fish and Japanese, I guess, cuisine before you get into it too far.
Right. It's the seasonality, respect to ingredients, and also kind of more spiritual aspect that I think you need to
definitely
know.
Yeah.
Right.
It's definitely, yeah, it's not easy, you know, like any kitchen job, but in sushi is it's like 85% prep, you know, a lot of preparation.
Right. And if you went to the sushi school, do you think that was a foundational it's like a necessity to go to, and instead of going to traditional sushi restaurants and start from the bottom, which one would you think?
Maybe, you know, me being a white chef too, so it was definitely hard back then. So it gave me like a great foundation to get started in the Japanese like culinary world, for sure.
Mm. Right. And I'm sure there are more references, English literature and references to look into your different types of fish and all those names compared to when you started, I guess.
Yeah. Like when I started, I would go to like the Japanese bookstore and get like sushi magazines that, you know, I couldn't even read, but, you know, I would study the pictures and stuff like that just so I knew everything.
Right. Well, fish is hard to buy looking at the pictures because it's so difficult to distinguish.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but then do you think it's necessary to speak Japanese?
No, you know, it's such a global cuisine. There's, you know, sushi chefs of all walks of life now. So,
okay. So listeners, if you're interested in studying sushi, it sounds like it's much easier than 20 years ago when we studied.
Definitely, you know, plus there's different levels, you know, it doesn't have to be like super high end. You could get like a little more casual restaurant and be able to learn a little bit faster. Like more high end, you're not going to be able to touch fish, you know, right away. So it's going to probably take a little bit longer.
Right. Well, in the end, you have to get to the essence of that authentic mindset of sushi chefs, I think, to pursue the best. But yeah, it's interesting because sushi started as a fast food in Edo period. So,
right.
Why not? Okay, so what are your plans and dreams?
My plans to get this restaurant busy, nice and busy, you know, and kind of showcase my cuisine. We also opened a bento, sushi bento place right here by MetLife as well. So the goal is to expand on that too, which is nice. Mm. So like custom bento sushi boxes.
Nice. Well, it's going to keep you busy.
It's like definitely keeping busy. But yeah, I just want the best for Coral, you know, to let people experience my cuisine and, you know, tasty sushi. And yeah.
Right. And are you planning to go back to Japan sometime soon?
I hope so. It's a little busy with this thing right now for maybe not this year.
Right. Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, my son's going to summer school this summer. Yeah, he's going to be in Japan over a month. Should be interesting. Yeah.
Interesting. Wow, that's amazing. Right? Do you think his kid's going to be a sushi chef?
I don't know about that.
We'll see what happens.
He might. He's a very creative kid. We'll see how he likes cooking.
All right. So... okay, so where can we find your updates online and on social media?
Instagram, we have the Coral Omakase, Bento by 0.7. Mine is Tuna Face, FASE on Instagram, Twitter. Yeah.
Okay, awesome. Yes, again, congratulations. And I really think, you know, you say creative, but you have very delicate, very authentic creativity. And I really admire, because not so many people can do it. So, yeah. So congratulations and good luck.
Thank you. I very appreciate it. Thanks for having me back on the show.
All right. Hopefully you come back sometime in the future.
So, yeah, you got to come and eat again too.
Oh, yeah. Anytime.
Great.
All right. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikwatema.com. Japanese is a weekly program and it's always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Engineer is Liam Warner, and thanks for listening. I will see you next week. Japanese is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.